I think you'll have very little trouble in finding the rooms. If there's any question about the third room listed on there, it is through this door and to the left. Now I would like to call your attention to the program tonight, to the program and theme of this fall conference, and invite you to hear our speaker for lecture number one, Father John Hardin. There's very little that I can tell you about Father Hardin that you do not already know through the brochures and information that we put out. I asked him what I should say, and he said, "Say something good." So I'm saying that we're glad to have him tonight and hope that you will give him a good hearing.
My dear friends in Christ, first I want to thank you for the opportunity of allowing me to speak to you. It is obviously not often that I have a chance to address people whom I consider fellow Christians and wayfarers with me on the road to the destiny to which we have been commonly called by Christ. I should begin by saying that the immediate reason for my being here is one of my former students, the Reverend Philip Steele, who is currently a student in the theological student body here, whom I had in class at Western Michigan University. I have been asked to speak on the subject of contemporary Protestant theology. And as I like to do in class, I think we would just briefly explain what we want to talk about and then get inside of the material itself. By theology, I understand some kind of systematic understanding of the Christian faith. Theology, therefore, adds to the dimension of faith the element of an intelligent, rational, and systematic penetration of the principles that have been enunciated in God's revelation. The Protestant theology about which we want to speak this evening may be one of two kinds. It may either be ecclesiastical, as found in the manuals of theology put out by schools of theology, as found in confessions of faith, as commonly taught in the pulpits of the various churches, and secondly, and on a broader spectrum, the theology that is taught by individuals who are Protestants, although not as such representing denominations. By contemporary, I would understand the theology of the last generation, because changes have occurred in the whole of Christian thought, insights, implications, and we trust future prospects that Christianity has not known for centuries. It seems more than just ambitious to try to speak about any theology, let alone contemporary thought, with its wide variety of opinion and its clash of ideals, and particularly in reaching as diverse a subject as Protestantism, it seems that to try in 1 hour to cover that field would be presumptuous. I thought, therefore, I would help myself and possibly help you by dichotomizing the field of Protestant thought into two segments. One that is popularly called the liberal, which I would add the naturalistic, and the other that is popularly called the conservative, or that I would call the revelational. It is of more than passing importance, I think, to distinguish between these two broad extremes of Protestantism. Indeed, in teaching Protestant theology as I do, or have for 10 years to my Jesuit confreres, I've been at pains to point out the importance of recognizing Protestantism less as a lineal concept such as you might find in Catholicism, and more as a spectrum from one extreme to another. It is further important, I think, to understand the difference between these two and to somehow juxtapose them in order to better appreciate the prospects of Christian unity and among whom and with whom unity is possible. Finally, still more to spare myself and spare you the having to listen to generalities, I thought I would boil each one down to an illustrative sample. And as a sample of the liberalizing or naturalistic type of Protestant theology, I will take for examination Bultmann's demythology. And as an example of what I would call the second type, the revelational, I will ask you to re-examine with me some of the thinking currently being done in Protestant circles on the theology of the ministry, on the correlative relationship between clergy and laity, because it seems to me that there particularly is the great hope, as also the possible nemesis of any future Christian unity. If I seem to be reading from prepared notes, I assure you they are my own. During the last 2 decades, a new type of rationalism has arisen under the leadership of Rudolf Bultmann, who contributed his share to the growth of form criticism. His essay on the New Testament and mythology, first published in 1941, was the starting point of an avalanche of writing, pro and con not just Bultmann, but pro and con Christianity. Bultmann's thesis is deceptively simple. He demands that the Gospels be demythologized or expurgated of every element of myth, quotes, on the score that the biblical view of the world belonged to a cosmology of a pre-scientific age and is therefore unacceptable or at least unpalatable to the modern man. However, what raises him and his followers above the level of Strauss, for example, and the radical demythologist, if you want to call them that, of the century before, and makes his theory much more elusive, is the constant protest that he makes in his followers that all of this is merely reinterpreting and does not affect the substance of the Christian faith. His followers claim that you not only remain a believer, but improve, if not actually discover, the true kerygma, or message of Christ, by clearing the Bible of its mythological haze. On their premises, no appeal can be made to the Jesus of history from a mythological Christology, because they reject the Gospels as historical knowledge, which in any case does not possess existential value so much as a kind of a backdrop. Fundamental to demythology is a dogmatic assumption that the whole language and spirit of the New Testament are mythical in character. The world is viewed as a three-storied structure with the earth in the center, the heavens above, and the underworld below. Heaven is the abode of God and of celestial beings, the angels. The underworld is hell. Even the earth is more than the scene of natural everyday occurrences. Quoting Bultmann, it is the scene of the supernatural activity of God and his angels on the one hand and of Satan and his demons on the other. These forces intervene in the course of nature and in all that men think and will and do. Miracles are by no means rare. Man is not in control of his own life. That, by the way, I think should be framed. Man is not in control of his own life, which Bultmann wants him to be. Evil spirits may take possession of him. Satan may inspire him with evil thoughts. Alternatively, God may inspire his thoughts and guide his purposes. He may grant him heavenly visions. He may allow him to hear his word of succor or demand. He may give him the supernatural power of his spirit. History does not follow a smooth, unbroken course. It is set in motion and controlled by these supernatural powers. So far, Bultmann, in characterizing the New Testament. Into this world of supernature, the New Testament has implanted the event of the redemption as the subject of its preaching. It proclaims in the language of mythology that God sent forth his Son, a pre-existent divine being, who appeared on earth as man, died the death of a sinner on the cross, and thus made atonement for the sins of men. His resurrection marked the beginning of a cosmic catastrophe. Death, as the consequence of sin, is abolished, and the demoniac forces are deprived of their power. The risen Christ is exalted to the right hand of God in heaven and made Lord and King of the universe. He will finally come again in the clouds of heaven to complete the work of redemption, when the resurrection and judgment of all mankind will follow. Sin, suffering, and death will then in this mythological world be abolished. What, Bultmann asks, should the modern man make of all these concepts? All of this, says Bultmann, can be traced to the contemporary mythology of Jewish apocalyptic and the Gnostics, whether Jewish or Christian. To the extent to which the supernatural element of the Gospels has been implanted upon the original teachings of Jesus, it is mythological, and it is that which scandalizes the modern man. And the job of man, therefore, if he is ever to accept the teachings of Christ, is to scrape off the elements that are or have been superadded to find the inner natural, not supernatural, core that lies beneath. Now, what is the real gospel in Bultmann's thesis? Because according to Bultmann, even Paul and John, the apostles, somehow were overcome by the mythical world in which they lived and added something to the teachings of Jesus. In the opinion of Bultmann, the true objective of the gospel message never was to describe supernatural events taking place in space and time, but rather that under a mythical garb, the gospel story was intended to announce God's coming to man's soul, or self, and the radical change that would thus be accomplished in man's existence. When the gospel story, so it is said, is proclaimed and we really hear it, when we are not enslaved by these supernatural elements, we become aware of our misery, namely that our inner self is enslaved by the powers of the world, such as worry, sin, and death, and therefore unable to live a life truly our own. Since the same story calls forth belief in its truthfulness, however, the self is delivered from the tyranny that surrounds us, and we are enabled to live a life of new and true spontaneity. This change of existence, this getting away from the angst to which we are all naturally subject, in Bultmann's vocabulary, means an act of divine grace. And this, in his language, is identical with the New Testament concept of redemption. To be emphasized is that the change that takes place in man's soul comes from the hearing of the message of the gospel rather than from any action on the part of Christ as any historically or empirically established personality. For Bultmann, Christ might have as little or as much reality as Buddha. All the effect you produce yourself. To evaluate Bultmann's approach to the New Testament, we should briefly examine his concept of history, which practically determines the structure of demythology. And to know that, we've got to go back to the sources from which he derived most of his ideas. In what follows, allow me to distinguish between two types of Protestants that I have in mind. Remember, I prefaced my remarks by saying, I consider this naturalism. The influence of Immanuel Kant's first two critiques on Protestant theology is a matter of record. By distinguishing between pure reason, as it dealt with the experiential, phenomenal world, or theoretical reason, and pure reason as it sought the unities that lie behind experience, or practical reason, Kant succeeded in preserving both the contemporary methods of natural science and the concept, so he thought, of theology, even of Christianity. Reason, he felt, can itself feel at home in either world, since the forms of intuition or perception, time and space, and the categories of understanding, particularly causality, as they enter the production of the phenomenal world, express an inner necessity of the mind itself, just as do the three great ideas of practical reason, God, world, and soul. But the price of this validation, to make sense of Christianity to a thinking mind, and if there's anything that I find every thinking Christian meets as a crisis at a state university, it is to validate his faith. Now, the price of Kant's validation was to recognize the limits of human understanding and practical reason, particularly the absence of all warrant or using experience to find evidence of God, or the soul, or any of the postulates of practical reason in our knowledge of nature. the existence of God can be postulated, Kant said. But this rests on the character of the moral self. You need a God. You want a God. It would be so nice, as Sigmund Freud says, if there was a God. But this God does not exist as the result of empirical phenomena, rationally examined. In any case, therefore, all of this is only a postulation. It is not a demonstration. Now, Protestant theologians, whom we regard as typical of the naturalistic school, and their number is legion, drew the following important conclusion from Immanuel Kant. Reason may think God and reach after God by an inner necessity of its own. It may therefore postulate his existence. But reason cannot find God in experience as it encounters nature, nor can it prove God by any concepts belonging to nature. Solutions offered by such men as Strauss, Hermann, and Bultmann show how Kant enabled Protestantism, which was imbued with a spirit of rationalism and respect for the norms of natural science. Two things. Rationalism and respect for natural science, yet to find a positive gospel once more in the New Testament. An attempt, therefore, for Christians to live with themselves without becoming theologically schizophrenic. Kantianism of this type still dominates a large segment of theology in the Protestant churches. It is satisfied, I believe, with interpreting the resurrection of Christ, for example, as the substance of its faith, and yet as nothing more than the postulate or form in Kant's terminology of Christian belief. On closer scrutiny, we see that Kantian theologians inherited more of a problem than trying to reconcile the method of natural science with metaphysical theology by an appeal to religious postulates. They overlooked or ignored the fact that the world of cognitive experience relevant to theology includes more than simply nature. That is, the dimensions of predictable history. A historical revelation such as that of Judeo-Christianity, to which we can return again and again through a critical, rationally, intelligently critical assessment of its records, does not lend itself to productive interpretation if the mind can operate only with the categories implicit in personal experience. When the data of the New Testament are submitted for examination with certain predetermined criteria of judgment, the results are a foregone conclusion. Reason, so defined, we'll ask of historical material a conformity to absolute space and time, and a show of abstract causality which it cannot give. To demand a natural explanation of the incarnation or resurrection is to expect the impossible. The option is either to revise one's theory of knowledge or deny the existence of these mysteries. Bultmann and his followers have taken the option. in a more comfortable climate, where we examine what I believe is the most hopeful side of Christianity in the world, certainly the side that Catholicism looks to with hope of eventual some kind of reunification, we do not find a questioning either of the ability of the mind somehow to validate its faith, or less still, questioning the historicity of Christ's resurrection or of the reality of the transcendent phenomena that he produced to change men's lives during his own lifetime and ever since through the powers of grace. In a large part of Protestantism, and speaking as a Catholic, in the most hopeful segment of Protestantism, we find a re-examination of those basic values which are common to all Christians and have been the common heritage of the Christian world for 1500 years before the Reformation. In the lecture tomorrow, where we shall examine more closely Protestant ecumenism from the Catholic viewpoint, we will see more closely and in more detail some of these re-examinations. There is one, however, that strikes at the root, on the one hand, of that concept of the Reformation, which has remained quite aloof from other forms of Christianity. And on the other hand, I believe it offers to it and to the rest of the Christian world the greatest hope of obtaining God's grace. Ingrained in the Protestant mind is the notion of a universal priesthood of the laity. All believers, or in Luther's phrase, priests. The Magna Carta of this theology, which I believe in many ways distinguishes Protestantism from Catholicism, was Luther's appeal to the German nobility in 1520, when he declared, and I quote, "There has been a fiction by which the Pope, bishops, priests, and monks are called the spiritual estate, princes, lords, artisans, and peasants are the temporal estates. This is an artful lie and hypocritical invention, but let no one be made afraid of it. And for this reason, all Christians are truly of the spiritual estate, and there is no difference among them save of office." As he described in one very clear dramatic passage, if he said, speaking in parable, a group of Christians without clergy were stranded on an island and wanted to have the sacraments administered and someone to preach to them, they could choose one of their number, man or woman, didn't matter, and by their choice, that person would be as much priest or bishop as though all the popes and bishops of Catholicism had ordained him. The concept, therefore, of there not being a distinct order within the church, one the laity, the other the clergy, is, I believe, intrinsic to historic Protestantism. But much has happened since that declaration. Hence, the contemporaneous aspect of this crucial part of Protestantism. By returning to the Bible, the Reformers found there that Christ is the only head of the church, ruling the whole church by his Spirit. They thus eliminated all gradation of powers, rights, and authority, and were determined to have done with the system of a hierarchy and the identification of the church with a priestly, sacramental clergy. The church for them was a body of believers and forgiven sinners. But in reorganizing the church, which they did, their main attention was to avoid and remove what they considered flagrant abuses and corruptions of the dominant system, so that now a rising number of Protestant theologians feel that, I quote, "the Reformers' thinking on the church did not become fully biblical because, quite understandably, in the stress and heat of battle, it was strongly determined by protest and polemics. Moreover, Luther's defiant words that every baptized Christian had the power which the Pope, bishops, and priests had hid some pitfalls." Along with its opposition to the radical distinction between the clergy and laity, the Reformation also laid heavy stress on correct, pure teaching as the sustaining nourishment of the church, which required a specially qualified group of bearers of this office. At the same time, at least two of the sacraments were retained, and their administration in practice, if not in theory, was reserved for ministers. There consequently arose within Protestantism an inner ambiguity in the whole concept of its ministry, because on the one hand it tended toward a reestablishment of a kind of clergy, whereas on the other hand, the abolition of the distinction between clergy and laity was, at least in principle, maintained. Ministers continued to be ordained as before, and the dividing line between the people and the clergy remained substantially unchanged. No doubt, laymen acquired status in the Protestant churches, which they had never enjoyed under Rome, and the degree of lay control of church policy and doctrine became more or less depending how consistently the basic theory was applied, greater or lesser lay control, lay authority, depending on how strictly the priesthood of the laity was understood. But the essential difference stayed, and no amount of theorizing to the contrary in 400 years has changed the facts. Now the contemporary scene. Two vastly different trends I see are developing among Protestant theologians in reacting to the status quo. Some are indignant that after 400 years, the churches still show the practical recognition of a secondary status of the laity in comparison with the ministry, the breeding of passivity in the laity as a whole, and stressing the importance of office and ordination among the clergy. This reaction is most prominent in the Free Church and congregational traditions, where creedalism is least important and the local churches have ultimate authority. However, another and more dominant reaction has been to recognize the facts of history. Admit that persistence of a clerical order after four centuries answers to some kind of an inner religious need, and therefore to re-examine the meaning of universal priesthood and restore the ministry to something of its status before the Reformation. This trend is visible in practice by the amazing proportion of transfers from non-Episcopal churches, for example, Baptists, Disciples of Christ, Congregationalists, to Protestant churches which maintain a historic episcopate, notably the Methodists and Episcopalians. Fully one half the clergy of the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States, 50%, has come to it from other denominations, whereas one seldom hears the opposite. Protestant observers see in this a clear sign of restlessness throughout the Protestant world for some adjustment to traditional, that is, pre-Reformation concepts on the historic episcopate. This is further reflected in the unprecedented rise among the non-Episcopal traditions of what some have called pseudo-bishops. There has been extensive development in Presbyterianism, for example, of extra-constitutional offices of the general presbyter or presbytery executive. There are field secretaries, synodical presidents, ministerium churchmen, superintendents, and similar officials which developed in churches that until recently kept far aloof from even the semblance of an episcopate. The current movement to unite with the Episcopalians elicited a widespread response among Presbyterians favoring merger on the grounds that in this way the churches of John Calvin would regain, would you believe it, a hierarchical structure. I quote, "Contemporary and historical experience would seem to indicate that some form of episcopal order is natural to the church. And in any visibly Catholic church," Catholic with a small C, "such is inevitable." Assuming that Presbyterians want visible unity, I'm still quoting, "surely the most expressive and feasible way of setting forth the visible Catholicity of the local congregation is for it to be closely related to a fairly local bishop." Now, more challengingly, in the light of these and similar reappraisals of the centuries-old theology of the Reformation on the universal priesthood of the laity, we are less surprised to find periodic signs of respect or of what Reinhold Niebuhr called envy of the Catholic strength and unity under a corporate hierarchy terminating in the papacy. A little publicized commission of the Church of England made a lengthy report to the Archbishop of Canterbury, then Geoffrey Fisher. I quote, "I had to go to a publication of Bombay in India to find the text, but I found it." I quote, "The easy way in which the reformers simply wrote off the papacy, even as a possibility, illustrates the extent to which they ignored from the outset both the New Testament doctrine of the universal church as an inherent part of the gospel and the inheritance of the divine human society in the here and now of history. If such an institution as the universal church is to exist, exist as more than a sentiment and a vague ideal, then some such central institution would seem to be more than just a convenience. It is, so the Episcopalians felt, a pragmatic necessity. For the first time since the Reformation, a large and influential segment of Protestantism is examining one of its major premises, that by divine foundation, the Church of Christ is not composed of two distinct categories, the clergy and laity, nor subject under God to a visible authority. The examination going on is not sporadic, but as I've learned in more than 12 years of dialoguing with Protestants, including participation at the World Council in Evanston in 54, where the idea was first broached, at least to me, this examination has been growing in significance since the turn of the century. Its implications are momentous. And one of the functions of the Second Vatican Council is to give this kind of self-appraisal the encouragement it deserves. By way of epilogue, to tie up the two items that I try to present to you this evening, I believe that American Protestantism is currently in a state of extreme tension. I believe this tension is more than merely liberalism versus conservatism. I frankly believe it is a conflict that has been born of two divergent concepts of the Christian religion. The one concept I would equate with the highest form of naturalism, in which, in the last analysis, man, or at least society, works out his own destiny. On the other hand, there is a concept of the Christian faith which I find in, for example, my confreres on the faculty with me at Western, and I trust in my audience, I find a concept of the Christian faith which is really a faith in God and not merely in man, which implies, on the one hand, that God has spoken, that there has been an objective breakthrough, that God has actually communicated something of himself to the human mind in what we call divine revelation. I further believe that God's grace is being specially poured upon all of us, and certainly upon those who are searching for the true meaning of the gospel, who in the sincerity of their humble willingness to believe in God ask for nothing more than to be told, what did God reveal? Catholicism has a pat answer. One of my Protestant ministers told me, friends, it's so easy for you Catholics. All you do is open up the latest encyclical and there you have it. For a good part of a year at Western, I had to disprove to my fellow faculty members that although I was a Catholic, I could think for myself. The image of Catholicism, which this second type of Protestantism sees, on the one hand is tantalizing. It's attractive because it at least claims to have that revelation. On the other hand, it fears. and understandably fears the cost that would seem to have to be paid to even suggest the re-examination of the possibility of having a visible authority speak and communicate that revelation. I like to think of the best in Protestantism and the best in Catholicism as corresponding to what you may have heard recently broached in Protestant circles, is a two-way of looking at faith. The one of Abraham and the other of Moses. Abraham, the prophet and seer. The one with a vertical, direct communication with God. The other of Moses, also in contact with God, yet by definition, institutionalizing, categorizing, if you will, authorizing the revelation that he received from God. I think it is well for Protestants to know that there are both attitudes as much in Catholicism as in Protestantism. And that on the one hand, Protestantism is not all just the direct vertical communication with God. That there is this search, as we've just seen, for some kind of structured ministry which believes itself to be divinely authorized to communicate the message of Christ. And correspondingly in Catholicism, there is always that search for finding God in the deepest recesses of the soul, of finding God in the depths of a man's heart, where ultimately resides not just the voice of conscience, but in the words of St. Augustine, the only true teacher of mankind, who is Jesus Christ. My hope is, as I see this, my hope is that Catholicism may discover more deeply this vertical dimension, that inner spirit of relationship with Christ, and that Protestantism might at least look at and see the value of a Christianity which is indeed from God, but also in man. I thank you.